Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
Pat Jordan didn't start out wanting to be a writer. He started out wanting to be a pitcher. His prowess as a very young man convinced the Milwaukee Braves that he could succeed in that line. Jordan has the photo of himself with Warren Spahn to prove it. But on a succession of disappointing nights in the low minors, it became evident that Jordan would never pitch in the bigs. As it turns out, baseball's loss has been journalism's gain. Pat Jordan went on to become an extraordinary chronicler of athletes and their games and their lives beyond their vocations. On the occasion of the recent publication of the best sports writing of Pat Jordan, I had the opportunity to speak with the author. I began by asking him what it was like to read again some of the articles and profiles that he'd written decades earlier.
Well, you know, it's funny. Alex, my editor, picked out about 100 stories. And when he gave them to me, some of the ones that I thought were really terrific, I didn't like as much anymore over the years. And some that I had really forgotten about, I liked an awful lot. One of the problems is you equate the story with how much fun you had doing it. Mm. And some stories that I really enjoyed doing maybe weren't as good as some stories that I really had to pull teeth to do. And I had maybe remembered them as being a real struggle. But they might be better than the ones that were effortless.
In 1980, you wrote about Steve and Cindy Garvey for Inside Sports. I don't know how many of your potential interviewees read that story, but I found myself wondering if anybody who did read it would consent to be interviewed by you.
Well, my editor at the New York Times years ago said that if I came to his door, he would put his sofa up against the door and the dresser and not let me in. But, and this is the guy I've been working with for 10 years, you know. But the irony is, if you're a good guy, I'm the best guy in the world to show up at your door because I just want to get you the way you are. I want to capture you as you are. If you're not a good guy, maybe I'm not the best guy to do the story as far as your image is concerned. But my philosophy about that is, if you're a good guy, I can be hard on you because I know the fact that I like you will show through. Mm. And if you're not a good guy and I'm really not crazy about you, I bend over backwards for you because I also know that my dislike will show through. I try to even the playing field for even unpleasant interviews as much as I can.
Well, in that aforementioned interview with Steve Garvey and his wife, Cindy, you have Cindy saying, you quote her as saying, "I hope in the next year my husband can develop to keep my interest." Did you think twice about including that remark and remarks like that?
No. You want to know the truth? I'm so conscious of just getting the story right that I don't even think about the result. Sometimes I'll write a story and I'll have something explosive like that in it. And I won't notice it. And then after the story comes out and, you know, everything hits the fan, and all of a sudden I'm being called up by radio stations and so forth, and people say, "Do you realize what you did?" But I don't realize it at the time. I'm so single-focused about just making sure I get Cindy's quote right and make sure I get the nuance of the moment right. I don't think about whether the quotes are explosive or not. I mean, you know, maybe sometimes I would, like in the Steve Carlton story.
Oh, yeah.
That I knew, that, you know, but generally I don't.
I want to read a little bit of that piece just to give our listeners a sense of your writing. This is entitled Thin Mountain Air from Philadelphia Magazine in 1994. At one point in that essay, you write, "As a pitcher, Carlton knew his limitations, a mind easily baffled by intricacies. There were so many batters, their strengths and weaknesses confused him, so he refused to go over batters' tendencies in pregame meetings. He blocked them out of his consciousness and reduced pitching to a mere game of toss between pitcher and catcher, his personal catcher, Tim McCarver." A little later in that same piece, "To prevent any chattering before a start, he had the Phillies build him a $15,000 mood behavior room next to the clubhouse. It was soundproof with dark blue carpet on the floors, walls, and ceiling. He'd sit there for hours in an easy chair, staring at a painting of ocean waves rushing against the shore. A disembodied voice intoned, 'I am courageous, calm, confident, and relaxed. I can control my destiny.' Carlton," said teammate Dal Maxville, "lived in, quote, a little dark room of his mind." When you visited with Steve Carlton in his concrete bunker in Colorado in 1994, he'd been retired for almost a decade. Were you surprised by the man you encountered at that time?
Absolutely. This is one of the stories that I did for a friend of mine. You know, they weren't paying much money, but he pleaded with me to do it for Philadelphia Magazine. And I knew really nothing about him except as a pitcher, and I knew he didn't like to talk to the press. So, I was going to do this Hall of Fame story. He was going to be elected in the Hall of Fame and inducted in Cooperstown. And the guy I met was somewhat crazy. He started talking about the Elders of Zion and how they control the world, and the United Nations is coming in black helicopters to confiscate all our guns, and on and on and on, and I just let him talk. I mean, I was shocked myself at what he was saying.
One of the more poignant moments in that chronicle of Steve Carlton involves his wife. I came away from reading the story feeling very, very sorry for her.
Well, she divorced him somewhat later, so I guess she finally got the picture. But that was a sad thing. They were sitting in this concrete bunker with only a space heater. It was freezing up there in Durango, and nothing on the walls, no pictures, no clocks. Deeb didn't believe in clocks. No television. It was almost like a cave. It was just a sad situation. At least for her, this is what he wanted, so it wasn't sad for him.
Your portrait of Wilt Chamberlain, which appeared in Philadelphia Magazine 11 years ago, suggests that you found Wilt to be an extraordinarily likable man who had been badly served by the press. How so?
Well, Wilt had so much talent, and he was one of the first of the very talented big men, you know, the guys who could move with the ball and shoot and all that. The expectations on him were always so great that I don't think anybody could have lived up to him, and he did a pretty good job of it, though. But I met him and Bill Russell. And Bill Russell was one of the most unpleasant men I ever met in the business, and Wilt Chamberlain was one of the nicest. And yet their image in the media was the complete opposite. Wilt was the egocentric guy who was only worried about himself, and Bill was a very intelligent, esoteric guy who could talk about anything. But the opposite was true. Wilt was a wonderful man, and I enjoyed being with him at his house. He was terrific. And I think I wrote later in the Q&A that he called up my wife at midnight to talk to her until 2 in the morning. And when I got back home, she was dead tired when she picked me up at 6 a.m. at the airport. And she said, Wilt was on the phone with me all night. And he was just a great guy.
In 2004, Harper's published a story of yours about a baseball player who had assumed mythical proportions, at least in the minds of some. His name is Gregory Nash, nicknamed Toe, and Chuck Lamar, the general manager of the Tampa Bay Devil Rays, told the world that Nash had, quote, Mark McGwire power and Doc Gooden's arm. How much did you know about Toe Nash when you started working on that story?
Be honest with you, I knew very little. My researcher, Mike Sharp in Kansas City, sent me a copy of an ESPN article about Toe Nash, and he said, you ought to do this guy. And I read the article, and basically the article was very laudatory about this mythical giant who came out of sugarcane fields and hit home runs and was a can't-miss natural, you know, like Robert Redford in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually sold it to the New York Times and went out to interview him, and I find out that he's in jail for statutory rape. He's been arrested for drug charges. He's certainly not a myth. He never worked in the sugarcane fields. As a matter of fact, he was so lazy, he cut his uncle's lawn once and stopped in the middle of the lawn because it was too much for him, and he quit. There was nothing mythical about him, but of course ESPN never went and interviewed him. So I discovered all this stuff. I mean, I had to interview Toe in jail, and I interviewed his probation officer, district attorney, arresting officers, lawyer, even the girl that he raped. And that's when the story became what it was.
Was it discouraging to learn the extent to which Nash had ruined his chances and ESPN had gotten the story wrong?
No, not at all. I just wrote the story that was there. I mean, if he had been this myth, I would have written it. I'm not tied to my inclinations ahead of time. I've gone to interview people like Bo Belinsky that I thought was somewhat of a jerk after he left baseball. And when I met him, he was one of the nicest guys I'd ever met. And so that's the story I wrote. And as a matter of fact, Sports Illustrated was a little taken back, and they said, well, I thought you weren't crazy about him when you went out there. And I said, well, I wasn't from what I had read about him, but the man I met was a nice guy.
In 2001, you wrote a feature story about O.J. Simpson for The New Yorker, and at one point in that story, you characterized Simpson, who talked obsessively, as, quote, a man unburdening himself of the most intimate truths of his heart, which, for O.J., are neither intimate nor true. That must have been an uncomfortable interview.
It really was. It's the first time I ever interviewed a pathological liar. You know, I think, was it the old Mary McCarthy thing about Lillian Hellman, where she said, Lillian, hello, she lied?
That's almost as good as shut up, he explained.
Right. I just put the tape on. I couldn't ask him a question. He just talked and talked incessantly about anything. I mean, it wasn't a question of me interview. I had like this list of 50 questions. I think I barely got through 10. But he just talked and talked. And he was determined to beat me down so that I wouldn't be able to ask him any questions he didn't want me to ask. But his answers to non-questions were better than any answers to my questions could have been.
Sometimes they do that for you, don't they?
Yeah, they help you out and they don't know it.
Once the best sports writing of Pat Jordan had been assembled, did you find you had a favorite among the pieces that had been collected?
Yeah, my favorite was the pork. The 5'5" college basketball player led the nation in scoring. The greatest shot maker I ever knew, and he was an absolute madman. He could go on and on. I told you in the story, one of his friends said he wasn't in shape. We're in Bridgeport, Connecticut. And he said, I'll show you what kind of shape I'm in. And he ran in hard-sole shoes from Bridgeport to Danbury, which was like 50 miles away, while his friends followed him in their car, you know, going 20 miles an hour. He ran there. When he got to Danbury, somebody said, that wasn't much of a run. He said, I'll run back. And they had to force him to get in the car.
And this guy was a personal friend. I mean, this wasn't just a great basketball player.
Oh, no, he was... the story is I was a 14-year-old kid, and he would have these manic three-man basketball games in his North End Boys Club gym, the kind of games that were life or death. And he was 21 at the time, and I was just a kid. And I would watch him. One game, one of his guys got hurt. The score was 11-11 to a game of 12. And Porky yanks me by the shirt onto the court. He said, all right, we got to finish the game out. He says, if you get the ball, pass it to me. Game goes on. The ball's bouncing around. I don't know anything. These guys are knocking me all over. They're men, and I'm only a kid. Ball lands in my hand at the foul line. I got the ball. I go up. As I'm about to throw a jump shot, Porky leaps at me, his own teammate, and tries to block the shot. The ball goes in. Swish. Porky hits me, knocks me down on my behind on the ground, and I jump up, and I say, Porky, we won. We won. And he screams at me. He says, what are you, insane? He says, nobody takes the last shot in Porky's team but Porky. And I became an object of ridicule in the gym. He would grab me. He says, you know how crazy this guy is? He took the last shot on Porky's team. And guys would look at me like I was a madman. And but that's how I know the pork.
The best sports writing of Pat Jordan is published by Percy Books. Pat Jordan joined me from WXEL in Boynton Beach, Florida. Pat, thank you very much for speaking with me. It's been a great pleasure, and good luck with the book.
Okay, thanks a lot, Bill.
My conversation with Pat Jordan will be featured in this week's program. I'll also be talking with Montreal writer Dave Stubbs about Canada's lone hope in the current NHL playoffs, the Montreal Canadiens. We'll have a story about the current state of eventing, the apparently increasingly dangerous competition involving horses, riders, jumps, and various other obstacles. We'll review Danica Patrick's achievement in Japan last weekend when she became the first woman to win an IndyCar race, and we'll have a story about that sport's attempt to achieve unity and greater popularity. Gee, you think Ms. Patrick's triumph will help with that? We'll also get Charlie Pierce's take on the NBA playoffs, and we'll hear from commentator Alyssa Eli. So join us, and remember you can always listen to the program at onlyagame.org.